The economy of the Third Reich. The foundation of Hitler's success in the first years rested not only on his triumphs in foreign affairs, which brought so many bloodless conquests, but on Germany's economic recovery, which in party circles and even among some economists abroad was hailed as a miracle. And indeed, it might have seemed so to a good many people. Unemployment, the curse of the 20s and early 30s, was reduced, as we have seen, from 6 million in 1932 to less than 1 million 4 years later. National production rose 102% from 1932 to 1937, and the national income was doubled. To an observer, Germany in the mid-30s seemed like one vast beehive. The wheels of industry were humming, and everyone was as busy as a bee. For the first year, Nazi economic policies, which were largely determined by Dr. Schacht, for Hitler was bored with economics, of which he had an almost total ignorance, were devoted largely to putting the unemployed back to work by means of greatly expanded public works and the stimulation of private enterprise. Government credit was furnished by the creation of special unemployment bills, and tax relief was generously given to firms which raised their capital expenditures and increased employment. But the real basis of Germany's recovery was rearmament, to which the Nazi regime directed the energies of business and labor, as well as of the generals, from 1934 on. The whole German economy came to be known in Nazi parlance as Wehrwirtschaft, or war economy, and it was deliberately designed to function not only in time of war, but during the peace that led to war. General Ludendorff, in his book Total War, Der Totale Krieg, whose title was mistranslated into English as The Nation at War, published in Germany in 1935, had stressed the necessity of mobilizing the economy of the nation on the same totalitarian basis as everything else in order to properly prepare for total war. It was not exactly a new idea among the Germans, for in Prussia during the 18th and 19th centuries, some 5/7 of the government's revenue, as we have seen, was spent on the army, and that nation's whole economy was always regarded as primarily an instrument not of the people's welfare, but of military policy. It was left to the Nazi regime to adapt Wehrwirtschaft to the third decade of the 20th century. The results were truthfully summed up by Major General Georg Thomas, chief of the military economic staff. History will know only a few examples of cases where a country has directed, even in peacetime, all its economic forces deliberately and systematically toward the requirements of war, as Germany was compelled to do in the period between the two world wars. Germany, of course, was not compelled to prepare on such a scale for war. That was a deliberate decision taken by Hitler. In the secret defense law of May 21, 1935, he appointed Schacht plenipotentiary general for war economy, ordering him to begin his work already in peacetime, and giving him the authority to direct the economic preparations for war. The inimitable Dr. Schacht had not waited until the spring of 1935 to start building up the German economy for war. On September 30, 1934, less than 2 months after he had become Minister of Economics, he submitted a report to the Führer entitled Report on the State of Work for War Economic Mobilization as of September 30, 1934, in which he proudly stressed that his ministry has been charged with the economic preparation for war. On May 3, 1935, 4 weeks before he was made plenipotentiary for war economy, Schacht submitted a personal memorandum to Hitler which began with the statement that the accomplishment of the armament program with speed and in quantity is the problem of German politics. Everything else, therefore, should be subordinate to this purpose. Schacht explained to Hitler that since armament had to be camouflaged completely until March 16, 1935, when Hitler announced conscription for an army of 36 divisions, it was necessary to use the printing press to finance the first stages. He also pointed out with some glee that the funds confiscated from the enemies of the state, mostly Jews, and others taken from blocked foreign accounts, had helped pay for Hitler's guns. Thus, he cracked, our armaments are partially financed with the credits of our political enemies. Though at his trial at Nuremberg he protested in all innocence against the accusations that he had participated in the Nazi conspiracy to make aggressive war, He had done just the contrary, he proclaimed. The fact remains that no single person was as responsible as Schacht for Germany's economic preparation for the war which Hitler provoked in 1939. This was freely acknowledged by the army. On the occasion of Schacht's 60th birthday, the army publication Militärwochenblatt, in its issue of January 22, 1937, hailed him as the man who made the reconstruction of the Wehrmacht economically possible. And it added, the defense force owes it to Schacht's skill and great ability that, in defiance of all currency difficulties, it has been able to grow up to its present strength from an army of 100,000 men. All of Schacht's admitted wizardry in finance was put to work to pay for getting the Third Reich ready for war. Printing banknotes was merely one of his devices. He manipulated the currency with such legerdemain that at one time it was estimated by foreign economists to have 237 different values. He negotiated amazingly profitable, for Germany, barter deals with dozens of countries, and to the astonishment of orthodox economists, successfully demonstrated that the more you owed a country, the more business you did with it. His creation of credit in a country that had little liquid capital and almost no financial reserves was the work of genius, or, as some said, of a master manipulator. His invention of the so-called Meffo bills was a good example. These were simply bills created by the Reichsbank and guaranteed by the state and used to pay armament manufacturers. The bills were accepted by all German banks and ultimately discounted by the Reichsbank. Since they appeared neither in the published statements of the National Bank nor in the government's budget, they helped maintain secrecy as to the extent of Germany's rearmament. From 1935 to 1938, they were used exclusively to finance rearmament and amounted to a total of 12 billion marks. In explaining them once to Hitler, Count Schwerin von Krussig, the harassed minister of finance, remarked that they were merely a way of printing money. In September 1936, with the inauguration of the four-year plan under the iron control of Göring, who replaced Schacht as economic dictator, though he was almost as ignorant of business as was Hitler, Germany went over to a total war economy. The purpose of the plan was to make Germany self-sufficient in 4 years, so that a wartime blockade would not stifle it. Imports were reduced to a bare minimum, severe price and wage controls were introduced, dividends restricted to 6%, great factories set up to make synthetic rubber, textiles, fuel, and other products from Germany's own sources of raw materials, and a giant Hermann Göring works established to make steel out of the local low-grade ore. In short, the German economy was mobilized for war, and businessmen, though their profits soared, became mere cogs in a war machine, their work circumscribed by so many restrictions, by so many forms to fill out, that Dr. Funk, who succeeded Schacht in 1937 as Minister of Economics and in 1939 as President of the Reichsbank, was forced to admit ruefully that official communications now make up more than one half of a German manufacturer's entire correspondence, and that Germany's export trade involves 40,000 separate transactions daily, yet for a single transaction as many as 40 different forms must be filled out. Buried under mountains of red tape, directed by the state as to what they could produce, how much and at what price, burdened by increasing taxation and milked by steep and never-ending special contributions to the party, the businessmen who had welcomed Hitler's regime so enthusiastically because they expected it to destroy organized labor and allow an entrepreneur to practice untrammeled free enterprise became greatly disillusioned. One of them was Fritz Thyssen, one of the earliest and biggest contributors to the party. Fleeing Germany at the outbreak of the war, he recognized that the Nazi regime has ruined German industry. And to all he met abroad, he proclaimed, "What a fool, Dummkopf, I was." In the beginning, however, the businessmen fooled themselves into believing that Nazi rule was the answer to all their prayers. To be sure, the inalterable party program had sounded ominous to them with its promises of nationalization of trusts, profit-sharing in the wholesale trade, communalization of department stores and their lease at a cheap rate to small traders, as point 16 read, land reform, and the abolition of interest on mortgages. But the men of industry and finance soon learned that Hitler had not the slightest intention of honoring a single economic plank in the party program. The radical promises had been thrown in merely to attract votes. For the first few months in 1933, a few party radicals tried to get control of the business associations, take over the department stores, and institute a corporate state on lines which Mussolini was attempting to establish. But they were quickly thrown out by Hitler and replaced by conservative businessmen. Gottfried Feder, Hitler's early mentor in economics, the crank who wanted to abolish interest slavery, was given a post as undersecretary in the Ministry of Economics. But his superior, Dr. Carl Schmitt, the insurance magnate, who had spent his life lending money and collecting interest, gave him nothing to do, and when Schacht took over the ministry, he dispensed with Feder's services. The little businessmen, who had been one of the party's chief supports and who expected great things from Chancellor Hitler, soon found themselves, many of them, being exterminated and forced back into the ranks of wage earners. Laws decreed in October 1937 simply dissolved all corporations with a capital under $40,000 and forbade the establishment of new ones with a capital less than $200,000. This quickly disposed of one-fifth of all small business firms. On the other hand, the great cartels, which even the Republic had favored, were further strengthened by the Nazis. In fact, under a law of July 15, 1933, they were made compulsory. The Ministry of Economics was empowered to organize new compulsory cartels or order firms to join existing ones. The system of myriad business and trade associations organized during the Republic was maintained by the Nazis, though under the basic law of February 27, 1934, they were reorganized on the streamlined leadership principle and put under the control of the state. All businesses were forced to become members. At the head of an incredibly complex structure was the Reich Economic Chamber, whose leader was appointed by the state and which controlled 7 national economic groups, 23 economic chambers, 100 chambers of industry and commerce, and the 70 chambers of handicrafts. Amidst this labyrinthine organization and all the multitude of offices and agencies of the Ministry of Economics and the 4-year plan and the Niagara of thousands of special decrees and laws, even the most astute businessman was often lost, and special lawyers had to be employed to enable a firm to function. The graft involved in finding one's way to key officials who could make decisions on which orders depended, or in circumventing the endless rules and regulations of the government and the trade associations, became in the late 30s astronomical. An economic necessity, one businessman termed it to this writer. Despite his harassed life, however, the businessman made good profits. The heavy industries, chief beneficiaries of rearmament, increased theirs from 2% in the boom year of 1926 to 6.5% in 1938, the last full year of peace. Even the law limiting dividends to 6% worked no hardship on the companies themselves, just the opposite. In theory, according to the law, any amount above that had to be invested in government bonds. There was no thought of confiscation. Actually, most firms reinvested in their own businesses the undistributed profits, which rose from 175 million marks in 1932 to 5 billion marks in 1938, a year in which the total savings in the savings banks amounted to only 2 billions, or less than half the undistributed profits, and in which the distributed profits in form of dividends totaled only 1 billion 200 million marks. Besides his pleasant profits, the businessman was also cheered by the way the workers had been put in their place under Hitler. There were no more unreasonable wage demands. Actually, wages were reduced a little despite a 25% rise in the cost of living. And above all, there were no costly strikes. In fact, there were no strikes at all. Such manifestations of unruliness were verboten in the Third Reich. The serfdom of labor. Deprived of his trade unions, collective bargaining, and the right to strike, the German worker in the Third Reich became an industrial serf, bound to his master, the employer, much as medieval peasants had been bound to the lord of the manor. The so-called labor front, which in theory replaced the old trade unions, did not represent the worker. According to the law of October 24, 1934, which created it, it was the Organization of Creative Germans of Brain and Fist. It took in not only wage and salary earners, but also the employers and members of the professions. It was in reality a vast propaganda organization, and, as some workers said, a gigantic fraud. Its aim, as stated in the law, was not to protect the worker, but to create a true social and productive community of all Germans. Its task is to see that every single individual should be able to perform the maximum of work. The labor front was not an independent administrative organization, but, like almost every other group in Nazi Germany except the army, an integral part of the NSDAP, or as its leader, Dr. Ley, the stammering drunkard, to use Thyssen's phrase, said, an instrument of the party. Indeed, the October 24th law stipulated that its officials should come from the ranks of the party, the former Nazi unions, the SA and the SS. And they did. Earlier, the Law Regulating National Labor of January 20, 1934, known as the Charter of Labor, had put the worker in his place and raised the employer to his old position of absolute master, subject, of course, to interference by the all-powerful state. The employer became the leader of the enterprise, the employees the following, or Gefolgschaft. Paragraph 2 of the law set down that the leader of the enterprise makes the decisions for the employees and laborers in all matters concerning the enterprise. And just as in ancient times the lord was supposed to be responsible for the welfare of his subjects, so, under the Nazi law, was the employer made responsible for the well-being of the employees and laborers. In return, the law said, the employees and laborers owe him faithfulness. That is, they were to work hard and long, and no back talk or grumbling, even about wages. Wages were set by so-called labor trustees, appointed by the labor front. In practice, they set the rates according to the wishes of the employer. There was no provision for the workers even to be consulted in such matters. Though after 1936, when help became scarce in the armament industries and some employers attempted to raise wages in order to attract men, wage scales were held down by orders of the state. Hitler was quite frank about keeping wages low. It has been the iron principle of the National Socialist leadership, he declared early in the regime, not to permit any rise in the hourly wage rates, but to raise income solely by an increase in performance. In a country where most wages were based at least partly on piecework, this meant that a worker could hope to earn more only by a speed-up and by longer hours. Compared to the United States, and after allowances were made for the differences in the cost of living and in social services, wages in Germany had always been low. Under the Nazis, they were slightly lower than before. According to the Reich Statistical Office, they declined for skilled workers from 20.4 cents an hour in 1932, at the height of the Depression, to 19.5 cents during the middle of 1936. Wage scales for unskilled labor fell from 16.1 cents to 13 cents an hour. At the Party Congress in Nuremberg in 1936, Dr. Ley stated that the average earnings of full-time workers in the labor front amounted to $6.95 a week. The Reich Statistical Office put the figure for all German workers at $6.29. Although millions more had jobs, the share of all German workers in the national income fell from 56.9% in the Depression year of 1932 to 53.6% in the boom year of 1938. At the same time, income from capital and business rose from 17.4% of the national income to 26.6%. It is true that because of much greater employment, the total income from wages and salaries grew from 25 billion marks to 42 billions, an increase of 66%. But income from capital and business rose much more steeply, by 146%. All the propagandists in the Third Reich from Hitler on down were accustomed to rant in their public speeches against the bourgeois and the capitalist and proclaim their solidarity with the worker. But a sober study of the official statistics, which perhaps few Germans bothered to make, revealed that the much maligned capitalists, not the workers, benefited most from Nazi policies. Finally, the take-home pay of the German worker shrank. Besides stiff income taxes, compulsory contributions to sickness, unemployment, and disability insurance, and labor front dues, the manual worker, like everyone else in Nazi Germany, was constantly pressured to make increasingly large gifts to an assortment of Nazi charities, the chief of which was Winterhilfe, Winter Relief. Many a workman lost his job because he failed to contribute to Winterhilfe or because his contribution was deemed too small. Such failure was termed by one labor court, which upheld the dismissal of an employee without notice, conduct hostile to the community of the people, to be most strongly condemned. In the mid-30s, it was estimated that taxes and contributions took from 15% to 35% of a worker's gross wage. Such a cut out of $6.95 a week did not leave a great deal for rent and food and clothing and recreation. As with the medieval serfs, the workers in Hitler's Germany found themselves being more and more bound to their place of labor, though here it was not the employer who bound them, but the state. We have seen how the peasant in the Third Reich was bound to his land by the hereditary farm law. Likewise, the agricultural laborer, by law, was attached to the land and forbidden to leave it for work in the city. In practice, it must be said, this was one Nazi law which was not obeyed. Between 1933 and 1939, more than 1,300,000, farm workers migrated to jobs in industry and trade. But for industrial laborers, the law was enforced. Various government decrees, beginning with the law of May 15, 1934, severely restricted a worker's freedom of movement from one job to another. After June 1935, the state employment offices were given exclusive control of employment. They determined who could be hired for what and where. The workbook was introduced in February 1935, and eventually no worker could be hired unless he possessed one. In it was kept a record of his skills and employment. The workbook not only provided the state and the employer with up-to-date data on every single employee in the nation, but was used to tie a worker to his bench. If he desired to leave for other employment, his employer could retain his workbook, which meant that he could not legally be employed elsewhere. Finally, on June 22, 1938, a special decree issued by the Office of the Four-Year Plan instituted labor conscription. It obliged every German to work where the state assigned him. Workers who absented themselves from their jobs without a very good excuse were subject to fine and imprisonment. There was, it is obvious, another side to this coin. A worker thus conscripted could not be fired by his employer without the consent of the government employment office. He had job security, something he had rarely known during the Republic. Tied down by so many controls, at wages little above the subsistence level, the German workers, like the Roman proletariat, were provided with circuses by their rulers to divert attention from their miserable state. "We had to divert the attention of the masses from material to moral values," Dr. Lai once explained. "It is more important to feed the souls of men than their stomachs." So he came up with an organization called Kraft durch Freude, strength through joy. This provided what can only be called regimented leisure. In a 20th-century totalitarian dictatorship, as perhaps with older ones, it is deemed necessary to control not only the working hours, but the leisure hours of the individual. This was what strength through joy did. In pre-Nazi days, Germany had tens of thousands of clubs devoted to everything from chess and soccer to bird-watching. Under the Nazis, no organized social, sport, or recreational group was allowed to function except under the control and direction of Kraft durch Freude. To the ordinary German in the Third Reich, this official all-embracing recreational organization no doubt was better than nothing at all, if one could not be trusted to be left to one's own devices. It provided members of the labor front, for instance, with dirt-cheap vacation trips on land and sea. Dr. Lai built two 25,000-ton ships, one of which he named after himself, and chartered 10 others to handle ocean cruises for Kraft durch Freude. This writer once participated in such a cruise. Though life aboard was organized by Nazi leaders to a point of excruciation, for him, the German workers seemed to have a good time, and at bargain rates. A cruise to Madeira, for instance, cost only $25, including rail fare to and from the German port. and other jaunts were equally inexpensive. Beaches on the sea and on lakes were taken over for thousands of summer vacationers. One at Rügen on the Baltic, which was not completed by the time the war came, called for hotel accommodations for 20,000 persons. And in winter, special skiing excursions to the Bavarian Alps were organized at a cost of $11 a week, including car fare, room and board, rental of skis, and lessons from a ski instructor. Sports, every branch of which was controlled by the strength through joy, were organized on a massive scale, more than 7 million persons, according to the official figures, participating in them annually. The organization also made available at bargain rates tickets to the theater, the opera, and concerts, thus making available more highbrow entertainment to the laboring man, as Nazi officials often boasted. Kraft durch Freude also had its own 90-piece symphony orchestra, which continually toured the country, often playing in the smaller places where good music was not usually available. Finally, the organization took over the 200-odd adult education institutions which had flourished during the Republic, a movement which had originated in Scandinavia, and continued them, though adding a strong mixture of Nazi ideology to the instruction. In the end, of course, the workers paid for their circuses. The annual income from dues to the labor front came to $160 million in 1937 and passed the $200 million point by the time the war started, according to Dr. Lai. The accounting was exceedingly vague, being handled not by the state but by the finance office of the party, which never published its accounts. From the dues, 10% was earmarked for Kraft durch Freude, but the fees paid by individuals for vacation trips and entertainment, cheap as they were, amounted in the year before the war to $1,250,000,000. There was another heavy cost to the wage earner, as the largest single-party organization in the country, with 25 million members, the labor front became a swollen bureaucracy, with tens of thousands of full-time employees. In fact, it was estimated that from 20 to 25% of its income was absorbed by administration expense. One particular swindle perpetrated by Hitler on the German workers deserves passing mention. This had to do with the Volkswagen, the people's car, a brainstorm of the Führer himself. Every German, or at least every German workman, he said, should own an automobile, just as in the United States. Heretofore, in this country where there was only one motor car for every 50 persons, compared to one for every 5 in America, the workman had used a bicycle or public transportation to get about. Now Hitler decreed that a car should be built for him to sell for only 990 marks, $396 at the official rate of exchange. He himself, it was said, took a hand in the actual designing of the car, which was done under the supervision of the Austrian automobile engineer Dr. Ferdinand Porsche. Since private industry could not turn out an automobile for $396, Hitler ordered the state to build it and placed the labor front in charge of the project. Dr. Lai's organization promptly set out in 1938 to build at Fallersleben, near Braunschweig, the biggest automobile factory in the world, with a capacity for turning out 1.5 million cars a year. More than Ford, the Nazi propagandists said. The labor front advanced 50 million marks in capital, but that was not the main financing. Dr. Lai's ingenious plan was that the workers themselves should furnish the capital by means of what became known as a pay-before-you-get-it installment plan. 5 marks a week, or if a worker thought he could afford it, 10 or 15 marks a week. When 750 marks had been paid in, the buyer received an order number entitling him to a car as soon as it could be turned out. Alas for the worker, not a single car was ever turned out for any customer during the Third Reich. Tens of millions of marks were paid in by the German wage earners, not a pfennig of which was ever to be refunded. By the time the war started, the Volkswagen factory turned to the manufacture of goods more useful to the army. Swindled though he was in this instance and in many others, reduced, as we have seen, to a sort of industrial serfdom on subsistence wages, and less prone than any other segment of German society to subscribe to Nazism or to be taken in by its ceaseless propaganda, the German worker, it is only fair to say, did not appear to resent very bitterly his inferior status in the Third Reich. the great German war machine that hurtled over the Polish border at dawn on September 1, 1939, could never have been fashioned without the very considerable contribution that the German workmen made to it. Regimented he was, and sometimes terrorized, but so was everyone else, and centuries of regimentation had accustomed him, as it had all other Germans, to being told what to do. Though it is perhaps unwise to attempt to generalize about such things, this writer's own impression of the working man in Berlin and in the Ruhr was that while he was somewhat cynical about the promises of the regime, he had no more hankering for revolt than anyone else in the Third Reich. Unorganized as he was and lacking leadership, what could he do? A workman often put that question to you. But the greatest cause of his acceptance of his role in Nazi Germany was, without doubt at all, that he had a job again and the assurance that he would keep it. An observer who had known something about his precarious predicament during the Republic could understand why he did not seem to be desperately concerned with the loss of political freedom and even of his trade unions as long as he was employed full-time. In the past, for so many, for as many as 6 million men and their families, such rights of free men in Germany had been overshadowed, as he said, by the freedom to starve. In taking away that last freedom, Hitler assured himself of the support of the working class, probably the most skillful and industrious and disciplined in the Western world. It was a backing given not to his half-baked ideology or to his evil intentions as such, but to what counted most, the production of goods for war. Justice in the Third Reich. From the very first weeks of 1933, when the massive and arbitrary arrests, beatings, and murders by those in power began, Germany under National Socialism ceased to be a society based on law. Hitler is the law, the legal lights of Nazi Germany proudly proclaimed, and Goering emphasized it when he told the Prussian prosecutors on July 12, 1934, that the law and the will of the Führer are one. It was true. The law was what the dictator said it was, and in moments of crisis, as during the Blood Purge, he himself, as we have seen in his speech to the Reichstag immediately after that bloody event, proclaimed that he was the supreme judge of the German people, with power to do to death whomever he pleased. In the days of the Republic, most judges, like the majority of the Protestant clergy and the university professors, had cordially disliked the Weimar regime, and in their decisions, as many thought, had written the blackest page in the life of the German Republic, thus contributing to its fall. But at least under the Weimar Constitution, judges were independent, subject only to the law, protected from arbitrary removal, and bound, at least in theory, by Article 109 to safeguard equality before the law. Most of them had been sympathetic to National Socialism, but they were hardly prepared for the treatment they soon received under its actual rule. The Civil Service Law of April 7, 1933, was made applicable to all magistrates and quickly rid the judiciary not only of Jews, but of those whose Nazism was deemed questionable, or, as the law stipulated, who indicated that he was no longer prepared to intercede at all times for the National Socialist State. To be sure, not many judges were eliminated by this law, but they were warned where their duty lay. Just to make sure that they understood, Dr. Hans Frank, Commissioner of Justice and Reich Law Leader, told the jurists in 1936, "The National Socialist ideology is the foundation of all basic laws, especially as explained in the party program and in the speeches of the Führer." Dr. Frank went on to explain what he meant. "There is no independence of law against National Socialism. Say to yourselves at every decision which you make, how would the Führer decide in my place? In every decision, ask yourselves, is this decision compatible with the National Socialist conscience of the German people? Then you will have a firm iron foundation which, allied with the unity of the National Socialist People's State, and with your recognition of the eternal nature of the will of Adolf Hitler, will endow your own sphere of decision with the authority of the Third Reich, and this for all time." That seemed plain enough, as did a new civil service law of the following year, January 26, 1937, which called for the dismissal of all officials, including judges, for political unreliability. Furthermore, all jurists were forced to join the League of National Socialist German Jurists, in which they were often lectured on the lines of Frank's talk. Some judges, however anti-Republican they may have been, did not respond avidly enough to the party line. In fact, a few of them, at least, attempted to base their judgments on the law. One of the worst examples of this, from the Nazi point of view, was the decision of the Reichsgericht, Germany's Supreme Court, to acquit on the basis of evidence three of the four communist defendants in the Reichstag fire trial in March 1934. Only von der Lubbe, the half-witted Dutchman who confessed, was found guilty. This so incensed Hitler and Göring that within a month, on April 24, 1934, the right to try cases of treason, which heretofore had been under the exclusive jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, was taken away from that august body and transferred to a new court, the Volksgerichtshof, the People's Court, which soon became the most dreaded tribunal in the land. It consisted of two professional judges and five others chosen from among party officials, the SS and the armed forces, thus giving the latter a majority vote. There was no appeal from its decisions or sentences, and usually its sessions were held in camera. Occasionally, however, for propaganda purposes, when relatively light sentences were to be given, the foreign correspondents were invited to attend. Thus, this writer once observed a case before the People's Court in 1935. It struck him more as a drumhead court-martial than a civil court trial. The proceedings were finished in a day. There was practically no opportunity to present defense witnesses, if any had dared to appear in defense of one accused of treason, and the arguments of the defense lawyers, who were qualified Nazis, seemed weak to the point of ludicrousness. One got the impression from reading the newspapers, which merely announced the verdicts, that most of the unfortunate defendants, though not on the day I attended, received a death sentence. No figures were ever published, though in December 1940, Roland Freisler, the much-feared president of the People's Court, who was killed during the war when an American bomb demolished his courtroom during a trial, claimed that only 4% of the accused were put to death. Established even earlier than the sinister People's Court was the Sondergericht, the special court, which took over from the ordinary courts cases of political crime, or as the law of March 21, 1933, which established the new tribunal, put it, cases of insidious attacks against the government. The special courts consisted of three judges, who invariably had to be trusted party members, without a jury. A Nazi prosecutor had the choice of bringing action in such cases before either an ordinary court or the special court, and invariably he chose the latter, for obvious reasons. Defense lawyers before this court, as before the Volksgerichtshof, had to be approved by Nazi officials. Sometimes, even if they were approved, they fared badly. Thus, the lawyers who attempted to represent the widow of Dr. Klausener, the Catholic action leader murdered in the Blood Purge, in her suit for damages against the state, were whisked off to Sachsenhausen concentration camp, where they were kept until they formally withdrew the action. Hitler, and for some time Göring, had the right to quash criminal proceedings. In the Nuremberg documents, a case came to light in which the Minister of Justice strongly recommended the prosecution of a high Gestapo official and a group of SA men, whom the evidence, he thought, plainly proved guilty of the most shocking torture of inmates of a concentration camp. He sent the evidence to Hitler. The Führer ordered the prosecution dropped. Göring, too, in the beginning had such power. Once in April 1934, he halted criminal proceedings against a well-known businessman. It soon became known that the defendant paid Göring some 3 million marks. As Gerhard F. Kramer, a prominent lawyer in Berlin at the time, later commented, it was impossible to establish whether Göring blackmailed the industrialist or whether the industrialist bribed the Prussian prime minister. What was established was that Göring quashed the case. On the other hand, Rudolf Hess, deputy of the Führer, was empowered to take merciless action against defendants who, in his opinion, got off with too light sentences. A record of all court sentences of those found guilty of attacking the party, the Führer, or the state, were forwarded to Hess, who, if he thought the punishment too mild, could take the merciless action. This usually consisted of hauling the victim off to a concentration camp or having him bumped off. Sometimes, it must be said, the judges of the Sondergericht did display some spirit of independence and even devotion to the law. In such cases, either Hess or the Gestapo stepped in. Thus, as we have seen, when Pastor Niemöller was acquitted by the special court of the main charges against him and sentenced only to a short term, which he had already served while awaiting trial, the Gestapo snatched him as he was leaving the courtroom and carted him off to a concentration camp. For the Gestapo, like Hitler, was also the law. It originally was established for Prussia by Göring on April 26, 1933, to replace Department IA of the old Prussian political police. He had at first intended to designate it merely as the secret police office, Geheimes Polizeiamt, but the German initials GPA sounded too much like the Russian GPU, an obscure post office employee who had been asked to furnish a franking stamp for the new bureau, suggested that it be called the Geheime Staatspolizei, simply the secret state police, Gestapo for short, and thus unwittingly created a name the very mention of which was to inspire terror first within Germany and then without. In the beginning, the Gestapo was little more than a personal instrument of terror employed by Göring to arrest and murder opponents of the regime. It was only in April 1934, when Göring appointed Himmler deputy chief of the Prussian secret police, that the Gestapo began to expand as an arm of the SS, and, under the guiding genius of its new chief, the mild-mannered but sadistic former chicken farmer, and of Reinhard Heydrich, a young man of diabolical cast who was head of the SS Security Service, or SD, Sicherheitsdienst, become such a scourge, with the power of life and death over every German. As early as 1935, the Prussian Supreme Court of Administration, under Nazi pressure, had ruled that the orders and actions of the Gestapo were not subject to judicial review. The basic Gestapo law promulgated by the government on February 10, 1936, put the secret police organization above the law. The courts were not allowed to interfere with its activities in any way. As Dr. Werner Best, one of Himmler's right-hand men in the Gestapo, explained, as long as the police carries out the will of the leadership, it is acting legally. A cloak of legality was given to the arbitrary arrests and the incarceration of victims in concentration camps. The term was Schutzhaft, or protective custody, and its exercise was based on the law of February 28, 1933, which, as we have seen, suspended the clauses of the Constitution which guaranteed civil liberties. But protective custody did not protect a man from possible harm, as it did in more civilized countries. It punished him by putting him behind barbed wire. The first concentration camps sprang up like mushrooms during Hitler's first year of power. By the end of 1933, there were some 50 of them, mainly set up by the SA to give its victims a good beating and then ransom them to their relatives or friends for as much as the traffic would bear. It was largely a crude form of blackmail. Sometimes, however, the prisoners were murdered, usually out of pure sadism and brutality. At the Nuremberg trial, four such cases came to light that took place in the spring of 1933 at the SS concentration camp at Dachau, near Munich. In each instance, a prisoner was cold-bloodedly murdered, one by whipping, another by strangulation. Even the public prosecutor in Munich protested. Since after the blood purge of June 1934, there was no more resistance to the Nazi regime, many Germans thought that the mass protective custody arrests and the confinement of thousands in the concentration camps would cease. On Christmas Eve 1933, Hitler had announced an amnesty for 27,000 inmates of the camps, but Göring and Himmler got around his orders and only a few were actually released. Then Frick, the rubber-stamp bureaucrat who was Minister of the Interior, had tried in April 1934 to reduce the abuses of the Nazi thugs by issuing secret decrees placing restrictions on the wholesale use of Schutzhaft arrests and reducing commitments to concentration camps, but Himmler had persuaded him to drop the matter. The SS-Führer saw more clearly than the minister that the purpose of the concentration camps was not only to punish enemies of the regime, but by their very existence to terrorize the people and deter them from even contemplating any resistance to Nazi rule. Shortly after the Röhm purge, Hitler turned the concentration camps over to the control of the SS, which proceeded to organize them with the efficiency and ruthlessness expected of this elite corps. Guard duty was given exclusively to the Death's Head units, Totenkopfverbände, whose members were recruited from the toughest Nazi elements, served an enlistment of 12 years, and wore the familiar skull and bones insignia on their black tunics. The commander of the 1st Death's Head Detachment and the 1st commander of the Dachau camp, Theodor Eicke, was put in charge of all the concentration camps. The fly-by-night ones were closed down and larger ones constructed, the chief of which, until the war came when they were expanded into occupied territory, were Dachau near Munich, Buchenwald near Weimar, Sachsenhausen, which replaced the Oranienburg camp of initial fame near Berlin, Ravensbrück in Mecklenburg, for women, and after the occupation of Austria in 1938, Mauthausen near Linz, names which, with Auschwitz, Belzec, and Treblinka, which were later established in Poland, were to become all too familiar to most of the world. In them, before the end mercifully came, millions of hapless persons were done to death, and millions of others subjected to debasement and torture more revolting than all but a few minds could imagine. But at the beginning, in the 30s, the population of the Nazi concentration camps in Germany probably never numbered more than from 20,000 to 30,000 at any one time. And many of the horrors later invented and perpetrated by Himmler's men were as yet unknown. The extermination camps, the slave labor camps, the camps where the inmates were used as guinea pigs for Nazi medical research, had to wait for the war. But the early camps were not exactly humane. I have before me a copy of the regulations drawn up for Dachau on November 1, 1933, by its 1st commander, Theodor Eicke, who, when he became head of all the camps, applied them throughout. Article 11. The following offenders, considered as agitators, will be hanged. Anyone who politicizes, holds inciting speeches and meetings, forms cliques, loiters around with others, who, for the purpose of supplying the propaganda of the opposition with atrocity stories, collects true or false information about the concentration camp, receives such information, buries it, talks about it to others, smuggles it out of the camp into the hands of foreign visitors, etc. Article 12. The following offenders, considered as mutineers, will be shot on the spot or later hanged. Anyone attacking physically a guard or SS man, refusing to obey or to work while on detail, or bawling, shouting, inciting, or holding speeches while marching or at work. Milder sentences of 2 weeks solitary confinement and 25 lashings were given anyone making depreciatory remarks in a letter or other documents about National Socialist leaders, the state and government, or glorifying Marxist or liberal leaders of the old democratic parties. Allied with the Gestapo was the Security Service, the Sicherheitsdienst, or SD, which formed another set of initials that struck fear in the bosoms of all Germans, and later of the occupied peoples. Originally formed by Himmler in 1932 as the intelligence branch of the SS, and placed by him under the direction of Reinhard Heydrich, later internationally renowned as Hangman Heydrich, its initial function had been to watch over members of the party and report any suspicious activity. In 1934, it became also the intelligence unit for the secret police, and by 1938, a new law gave it this function for the entire Reich. Under the expert hand of Heydrich, a former intelligence officer in the Navy who had been cashiered by Admiral Raeder in 1931 at the age of 26 for refusing to marry the daughter of a shipbuilder whom he had compromised, the SD soon spread its net over the country, employing some 100,000 part-time informers who were directed to snoop on every citizen in the land and report the slightest remark or activity which was deemed inimical to Nazi rule. No one, if he were not foolish, said or did anything that might be interpreted as anti-Nazi without first taking precautions that it was not being recorded by hidden SD microphones or overheard by an SD agent. Your son or your father or your wife or your cousin or your best friend or your boss or your secretary might be an informer for Heydrich's organization. You never knew, and if you were wise, nothing was ever taken for granted. The full-time sleuths of the SD probably never numbered more than 3,000 during the 30s, and most of them were recruited from the ranks of the displaced young intellectuals, university graduates who had been unable to find suitable jobs or any secure place in normal society. Thus, among these professional spies, there was always the bizarre atmosphere of pedantry. They had a grotesque interest in such sidelines as the study of Teutonic archaeology, the skulls of the inferior races, and the eugenics of a master race. A foreign observer, however, found difficulty in making contacts with these odd men, though Heydrich himself, an arrogant, icy, and ruthless character, might occasionally be seen at a Berlin nightclub, surrounded by some of his blonde young thugs. They not only kept out of the spotlight because of the nature of their work, but in 1934 and 1935 at least, because a number of them who had spied on Röhm and his confederates in the SA were bumped off by a secret band that called itself Röhm's Avengers and took care to pin that label on the bodies. One of the interesting, if subordinate, tasks of the SD was to ascertain who voted no in Hitler's plebiscites. Among the numerous Nuremberg documents is a secret report of the SD in Cochem on the plebiscite of April 10, 1938. Copy is attached enumerating the persons who cast no votes or invalid votes at Kappel. The control was effected in the following way. Some members of the election committee marked all the ballots with numbers. During the balloting, a voter's list was made up. The ballots were handed out in numerical order, therefore it was possible afterward to find out the persons who cast no votes or invalid votes. The marking was done on the back of the ballot with skimmed milk. The ballot cast by the Protestant parson Alfred Wolfers is also enclosed. On June 16, 1936, for the first time in German history, a unified police was established for the whole of the Reich. Previously, the police had been organized separately by each of the states, and Himmler was put in charge as chief of the German police. This was tantamount to putting the police in the hands of the SS, which since its suppression of the Röhm revolt in 1934 had been rapidly increasing its power. It had become not only the Praetorian Guard, not only the single-armed branch of the party, not only the elite from whose ranks the future leaders of the new Germany were being chosen, but it now possessed the police power. The Third Reich, as is inevitable in the development of all totalitarian dictatorships, had become a police state. Government in the Third Reich. Though the Weimar Republic was destroyed, the Weimar Constitution was never formally abrogated by Hitler. Indeed, and ironically, Hitler based the legality of his rule on the despised Republican Constitution. Thus, thousands of decreed laws, there were no others in the Third Reich, were explicitly based on the emergency presidential decree of February 28, 1933, for the protection of the people and the state, which Hindenburg, under Article 48 of the Constitution, had signed. It will be remembered that the aged president was bamboozled into signing the decree the day after the Reichstag fire, when Hitler assured him that there was grave danger of a communist revolution. The decree, which suspended all civil rights, remained in force throughout the time of the Third Reich, enabling the Führer to rule by a sort of continual martial law. The Enabling Act II, which the Reichstag had voted on March 24, 1933, and by which it handed over its legislative functions to the Nazi government, was the second pillar in the constitutionality of Hitler's rule. Each 4 years thereafter, it was dutifully prolonged for another four-year period by a rubber-stamp Reichstag, for it never occurred to the dictator to abolish this once democratic institution, but only to make it non-democratic. It met only a dozen times up to the war, enacted only four laws, the Reconstruction Law of January 30, 1934, and the three anti-Semitic Nuremberg laws of September 15, 1935, held no debates or votes, and never heard any speeches except those made by Hitler. After the first few months of 1933, serious discussions ceased in the cabinet. Its meetings became more and more infrequent after the death of Hindenburg in August 1934, and after February 1938, the cabinet was never convened. However, individual cabinet members held the considerable power of being authorized to promulgate decrees, which, with the Führer's approval, automatically became laws. The secret cabinet council, Geheimer Kabinettsrat, set up with great fanfare in 1938, perhaps to impress Prime Minister Chamberlain, existed only on paper. It never met once. The Reich Defense Council, Reichsverteidigungsrat, established early in the regime as a war-planning agency under the chairmanship of Hitler, met formally only twice, though some of its working committees were exceedingly active. Many cabinet functions were delegated to special agencies, such as the Office of the Deputy of the Führer, Hess and later Martin Bormann, of the Plenipotentiaries for War Economy, Schacht, and Administration, Frick, and of the Delegate for the Four-Year Plan, Göring. In addition, there were what was known as the Supreme Government Agencies and National Administrative Agencies, many of them holdovers from the Republic. In all, there were some 42 executive agencies of the national government under the direct jurisdiction of the Führer. The diets and governments of the separate states of Germany were, as we have seen, abolished in the first year of the Nazi regime, when the country was unified, and governors for the states, which were reduced to provinces, were appointed by Hitler. Local self-government, the only field in which the Germans had seemed to be making genuine progress toward democracy, was also wiped out. A series of laws decreed between 1933 and 1935 deprived the municipalities of their local autonomy and brought them under the direct control of the Reich Minister of the Interior, who appointed their mayors, if they had a population of over 100,000, and reorganized them on the leadership principle. In towns under 100,000, the mayors were named by the provincial governors. For Berlin, Hamburg, and Vienna, after 1938 when Austria was occupied, Hitler reserved the right to appoint the burgomasters. The offices through which Hitler exercised his dictatorial powers consisted of four chancelleries, those of the president, though the title had ceased to exist after 1934, the chancellor, the title was abandoned in 1939, and the party, and a fourth known as the Chancellery of the Führer, which looked after his personal affairs and carried out special tasks. In truth, Hitler was bored by the details of day-to-day governing, and after he had consolidated his position following the death of Hindenburg, he left them largely to his aides. Old party comrades such as Göring, Goebbels, Himmler, Ley, and Schirach were given free rein to carve out their own empires of power, and usually profit. Schacht was given a free hand at first to raise the money for expanding government expenditures by whatever sleight of hand he could think up. Whenever these men clashed over the division of power or spoils, Hitler intervened. He did not mind these quarrels. Indeed, he often encouraged them, because they added status to his position as supreme arbiter and prevented any closing of the ranks against him. Thus, he seemed to take delight at the spectacle of three men competing with each other in foreign affairs. Neurath, the foreign minister, Rosenberg, the head of the party's foreign affairs department, and Ribbentrop, who had his own Ribbentrop Bureau which dabbled in foreign policy. All three men were at loggerheads with each other, and Hitler kept them so, by maintaining their rival offices until in the end he chose the dull-witted Ribbentrop to become his foreign minister and carry out his orders in foreign affairs. Such was the government of the Third Reich, administered from top to bottom on the so-called leadership principle by a vast and sprawling bureaucracy, having little of the efficiency usually credited to the Germans, poisoned by graft, beset by constant confusion and cutthroat rivalries, augmented by the muddling interference of party potentates, and often rendered impotent by the terror of the SS Gestapo. At the top of the swarming heap stood the one-time Austrian vagabond, now become, with the exception of Stalin, the most powerful dictator on earth. As Dr. Hans Frank reminded a convention of lawyers in the spring of 1936, there is in Germany today only one authority, and that is the authority of the Führer. With that authority, Hitler had quickly destroyed those who opposed him, unified and Nazified the state, regimented the country's institutions and culture, suppressed individual freedom, abolished unemployment, and set the wheels of industry and commerce humming. No small achievement after only 3 or 4 years in office. Now he turned, in fact he already had turned, to the two chief passions of his life, the shaping of Germany's foreign policy toward war and conquest, and the creation of a mighty military machine which would enable him to achieve his goal. It is time now to turn to the story, more fully documented than that of any other in modern history, of how this extraordinary man, at the head of so great and powerful a nation, set out to attain his ends.